Welcome to New Books and Gender Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation is with Daniel K. Williams, an associate professor of history at the University of West Georgia. His book, Defenders of the Unborn, The Pro-Life Movement Before Roe v. Wade, published by Oxford University Press, is the topic of this show. Williams portrays the origins of the pro-life movement not as a reactionary and anti-feminist one, but rather as a New Deal-inspired crusade for human rights and part of a progressive Catholic social agenda. They saw themselves as crusaders for the right to life, appealing to natural law and the Constitution of the United States. In the 1930s, pro-lifers stood against the utilitarian view of abortion liberalization promoted by secular doctors. After World War II, Catholic doctors and lawyers were equating abortion with the Holocaust and arguing for the fetus as protected by the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. In the early 1960s, debate over abortion moved to legislative and constitutional battles. Restrictive state laws began to crumble, and post-Vatican Catholic opposition to abortion continued to erode among the laity. The decade ended with a restructuring of the movement as it gained allies among young progressives, anti-war activists, Protestants, and evangelicals. Pro-life women expressing a feminism of difference became visible in the leadership ranks in what had been virtually an all-male public campaign. The pro-life movement's legislative victories were short-term. Roe v. Wade and changes in public opinion interrupted the ascendancy of the pro-life movement and its bipartisan identity to become part of a larger cultural battle. Williams offers an important contribution by highlighting the progressive origins of the pro-life movement before it became a conservative evangelical cause and an issue that continues to divide the nation. Here's my conversation with Daniel K. Williams. Now let me introduce you to the author, Daniel Williams. Hello, Dan.
Hi.
Welcome to the show, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Your book brings attention to a neglected period of the pro-life movement, decades before Roe v. Wade. But before we get into the book, tell us about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Defenders of the Unborn.
Well, thanks, Lillian. Yes, I'm an associate professor of history at the University of West Georgia. So I've spent the last 15 years studying the intersection between religion and politics in modern America. I started at Brown University as a PhD student, doing research that eventually became incorporated in a book called God's Own Party, which was my first book. That book traced the history of the Christian right. And as a result of writing that book, I realized that abortion was a somewhat puzzling issue in modern American politics. It didn't seem to neatly line up along the liberal conservative divide that we tend to use in understanding modern American politics. And I wanted to explore it further, and I'm glad that I did. So as a result of an additional 5 years of research after writing God's Own Party, I produced the book Defenders of the Unborn, which tells the story of the origins of the pro-life movement, and perhaps most surprisingly, the origins of the pro-life movement in a liberal political context.
Well, this topic of abortion is so divisive, contested. It's the history of it is, as you bring out, more complicated than we think. So you start off your book right off the bat with four pages on terminology, which you hardly ever see in a book regarding, you know, how we talk about pro-choice, pro-life, anti-abortion, pro-abortion, all these terms that are thrown around, oftentimes politicized in order to for people to make points against the opposition. So talk about terminology and the issues there.
Yes. Well, one of the things that I discovered in the course of researching this book is that supporters of reproductive rights and opponents of abortion are talking past each other because they can't agree on what terms they should use. So the terminology that we use today is very contested. There are a number of news media outlets, for example, that refuse to use the term pro-life except in quotation marks, and yet that, of course, is the preferred term by people who are opponents of abortion today. But furthermore, I found that the terms that we use today are historically contested and products of particular historical moments. So the term pro-choice, for example, did not originate until the early 1970s, and yet people were debating abortion in this country for decades before that. So then the question is, as a historian, what term should I use to describe supporters of abortion law liberalization in, say, the 1950s or the 1960s? And what I decided as a historian I should do would be to use the terms that my historical subjects used at the particular moments when they were debating abortion. So with rare exceptions throughout the book, I tried to give people a sense of the terms that were used at that particular moment in the abortion debate. So in 1965, I would not use a term like pro-choice because it would have been anachronistic. But then when I talk about debates in 1971 or 1972, I use the term pro-choice quite a lot. The same thing is true of the term pro-life or right to life. Those terms emerged at particular historical moments. And as a historian, I wanted to be faithful to my historical subjects. And I think by doing that, perhaps I was able to, I hope, communicate with people on multiple sides of the abortion debate, because they could recognize, I hope, that I was trying to treat my historical subjects fairly and in their own historical context.
Well, Dan, I appreciate what you're saying. Let me, I have to be honest, when I first got your book or saw your book, I was sort of, I guess, reluctant to take your book on. One of the reasons is, and I think you'll understand this, that you being male, writing a book about the pro-life movement, and right away that will bring a lot of suspicion to some readers about, you know, what is, especially feminist women who are going to say, you know, what is this guy doing writing this book about pro-life? And we kind of know the story of that, particularly since so many of the people in the pro-life movement early on in the earlier decades were basically men who were arguing these points. And it wasn't until the 1960s that you show the women really, really got into it. So anyway, what would you say to that?
Yes. Well, I understand that this is a difficult subject for many people for multiple reasons. One, obviously, is because of the gender issues involved. The other is because it's a contentious political subject today. And I think it obviously elicits very deep feelings on both sides. And so the question is this a topic that is worth studying historically, somewhat dispassionately, and is that achievable? And I would argue that it is. I would argue that supporters of abortion rights, strong supporters of abortion rights who perhaps are reluctant to pick up this book, should read it for multiple reasons. Number one, I think that we're not going to achieve any sort of common ground on the subject of abortion or even move forward in our political discourse on this subject if we don't fairly understand both sides. So if we only read the perspectives of historical actors who happen to agree with our own position, then I think we'll be impoverished as a result. We'll fail to really understand where the political debate is going. And I think supporters of abortion rights will probably be surprised at several things in the book, but a couple of major surprises would be, first of all, that the partisan division on abortion in the early 1970s might be exactly the opposite of what we might expect today. That is, a number of liberal Democrats were supporting the pro-life movement. A number of conservative Republicans, like Barry Goldwater, even for a short time Ronald Reagan, were on the other side of the abortion debate. And that's surprising. The gender division on the abortion debate, as you noted in your question, came a little bit later than most people would think. That is, the abortion legalization movement started among men, and then when it became a gender issue, it was not necessarily a division of women versus men. Rather, it was a division among women, that in the early 1970s, there were numerous women who were leading the pro-life movement, and of course, numerous women who were in support of abortion rights. But nationally, women were more likely than men to oppose abortion in the early 1970s. And so with surprises like that, I hope that readers would be intrigued enough to pick up the book to try to grapple with some of the issues and to see if perhaps reading the book gives them a different perspective on the historical trajectory of the issue, if not necessarily the political issue itself.
Well, Dana, I want to say that you did a really good job of a very, I think, a very fair, historically centered piece of work. So it's not a polemic. You're not advocating one thing or another. You're really trying to give us a story of something that has not been told. And what is that story that has not been told? There's some major historical problems that your book is bringing out.
Yes. First of all, I make the claim that the pro-life movement started long before Roe v. Wade. And that, I think, runs counter to the assumptions of most historians in the field, most journalists in the field. The general line of reasoning is that Roe v. Wade produced our modern abortion debate and that it was a backlash against Roe that produced the anti-abortion movement. And what I show is that actually this debate about abortion began at least as early as the 1930s. So the pro-life movement predated Roe by decades and as an organized movement by several years. But furthermore, more intriguingly than that, I argue that the pro-life movement began as a liberal political movement, and it was liberal for multiple reasons. It was liberal because it was rooted in human rights ideology that was associated very closely with post-war liberalism and with New Deal liberalism. And furthermore, it was liberal because most of the major pro-life leaders, activists in the late 1960s and early 1970s thought of themselves as liberals. Many of them voted Democratic. Most of them voted Democratic, actually. And they were supporters of the civil rights movement, of the anti-war movement. They thought of themselves as pursuing liberal political initiatives. And so, as a result, the pro-life movement emerged as a movement that was really not a good fit for the Republican Party. And then, as a result of developments that I described toward the end of the book, it ended up being associated with the Republican Party. But it was never a natural fit for that party. And I think one of the reasons that the abortion debate has proven so intractable today and has often been so misunderstood is because the partisan polarization on the issue does not make natural sense.
Okay, for listeners who are not aware of the history, don't know the history of abortion rights except after Roe v. Wade, let's go back to the 1930s when that's kind of where you begin. What was the situation culturally and legally regarding abortions? What was the consensus, if there was one?
Abortion was illegal everywhere in the United States. The state laws varied on abortion in the 1930s. There were a few states, for example, that would allow abortions in exceptional cases regarding dangers to a woman's health. And most states, though not all, allowed for abortion in cases in which a woman's life was endangered. But there were numerous illegal abortions. The best estimates, although the estimates vary widely, but the best estimates are that perhaps 200,000 illegal abortions per year occurred in the country in the 1930s. And so there were a few doctors who said that perhaps the law should be changed to allow women to obtain safe hospital abortions without having to resort to these illegal procedures. And when they began making that claim in several books that were published in the 1930s, there was an immediate reaction from Catholic doctors who viewed this as a dangerous assault on the sanctity of human life.
Now, the medical profession at this time in the 1930s was in agreement with the law that it should be illegal in most cases except for the life of the mother or something of that sort of thing. But these Catholic doctors that you're talking about, most of these are males. These are men, okay? And also the doctors who were advocating for abortion and liberalization were also men, and they had a particular viewpoint. And I want to talk about that viewpoint so we can understand what the pro-life viewpoint actually was. Let's talk about the doctors who were advocating for changing the law and liberalizing abortion. What were some of the reasons or some of the that they gave for that?
Yes. Well, one of the most surprising things to me was the fact that all of these doctors that I read about who advocated for the legalization of abortion accepted what would become the pro-life movement's claim that the fetus was a human life, was a human being. And so the argument that they made in favor of legalizing abortion was utilitarian. They did not ground their argument in women's right to privacy or women's right to equality, which of course would be the later claims of the feminist version of the pro-choice movement. Instead, they argued that although abortion was an evil, and in fact they even used that word on occasion, evil, to describe this, it was the lesser of two evils when compared with the fact that at least 5,000 women per year, according to many estimates, were dying as a result of these illegal abortions, and approximately 200,000 or so illegal abortions were occurring anyway. So they compared the anti-abortion laws to prohibition, which by the mid-1930s, it looked like a failed experiment. And they said that just as prohibition had failed to deter people from drinking, so the abortion laws were obviously failing to deter people from having abortions, and instead they were driving thousands of women per year to their deaths. So in order to prevent this situation, the law should allow for abortion in at least some cases. Most of them didn't say that abortion should be legal in all cases, but they said that at least for dangerous to a woman's health, suspected fetal deformity, maybe even socioeconomic considerations, abortion should be legal at a doctor's discretion.
And the Catholic physicians rose up against this, and you cast them as being progressive.
Yes.
And what do you mean by progressive in that 1930s progressivism?
They were strong supporters of the New Deal. They believed in helping the less fortunate. And they believed in the creation of a society that would value all human life, and that would value the lives of workers, that would value the lives of the poor, and that would certainly value the lives of the unborn. And they argued that their opponents were utilitarian in their value system. That is, that they were arguing that some lives could be sacrificed for the greater benefit of society, for the lives of others, and they said that that was a very dangerous assumption. It was the sort of assumption that would lead to an erosion of all of the liberal values that they held dear and that they associated with the New Deal. So they thought of themselves as defenders of the New Deal political order and of a Catholic social vision for society, which believed in protecting the rights of everyone.
They also had a kind of a slippery slope argument, right? If you allow abortion, then you're going to allow killing people who are disabled, who don't fit, who are a burden to society, and you can just keep going. Why just stop at abortion?
Right. That's exactly the argument that they made. And in the 1950s, this version of the argument became linked to their view of what had happened in Nazi Germany, and although supporters of abortion rights very much disagreed with this comparison and found it extremely offensive, it was widespread in the Right to Life movement, which was this argument that Nazi Germany had been based on the same sort of compromised views of human life that propelled the abortion rights movement, and that the next step after the legalization of limited abortion would be the legalization of what they called abortion on demand, that is, the legalization of elective abortion. And then after that, they argued maybe euthanasia would follow, maybe infanticide for disabled people would follow. They had a long slippery slope, as you said, a projection of the horrors that they believed would emerge from a society that accepted the principle of utilitarianism when it came to unborn human life as they saw it.
Okay, how do women figure in these arguments in terms of the pro-life arguments or the opposition? How do women, real women,
right,
who are carrying these future children, figure into their health, their concerns? How do they talk about that? Because they say everybody's talking about the fetus here.
Right.
Okay, what's happening to the women?
Right. Well, one of the remarkable things, and I think one of the surprising things to people who are coming at this subject from a 21st century perspective and with the knowledge of, say, the last four decades of debate on this issue, is that when we look back at the 1930s and the 1940s and 1950s, it's difficult to find women's voices anywhere on either side of the debate. So as you noted, this debate in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s was really a debate between men, that is, male professionals, doctors, and then later lawyers. And I think women were absent from the debate for several reasons. First of all, women at the time were largely excluded from the professions. And so because this was a debate happening in medical journals, not in the pages of the nation's newspapers, I suspect that a lot of women were unaware of the debate. And that was certainly true for women who would later identify with the pro-life movement. Repeatedly, the women who would emerge as leaders of the pro-life movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s had a fairly common story, which was that at some point in the mid-1960s or at some point in the late 1960s or at some point around 1970, when their own state legislature was debating abortion, they realized for the first time that a sizable number of people took a different view of the subject. So when women enter the debate as voices rather than as simply subjects that male actors were debating is really in the early 1960s. And in the early 1960s, there was one woman in California, Pat McGinnis, who took the lead in making an abortion rights argument that was grounded in the rights of women themselves. And that was really a new idea for the movement. She was surrounded in the abortion legalization movement by male doctors, by lawyers, by male professionals. She was one of the few women's voices to speak out on the issue on behalf of women's rights. But then, almost immediately, within just a few years, by 1965-66, women on the other side of the debate emerged as spokespersons for their cause. And women were the primary letter writers against abortion in state legislative debates such as that occurred in California in 1965 and then again in 1967. And as they were writing these letters, as they were trying to testify against these laws, some of these pro-life women realized that the male leaders of the pro-life movement, that is, the doctors, lawyers, and clerics, were doing both the cause and women themselves a disservice by marginalizing these women's voices. They argued that if pro-life women were going to win the fight against proposals to legalize abortion, that the women themselves would have to be the spokespersons, and that they had unique perspectives that they could contribute to the debate. And so by the early 1970s, the debate had really become a debate between two different groups of women. There were also a lot of men on both sides of the movement, and that would be true for a long time. But both the pro-choice women and the pro-life women believed that they were making arguments on behalf of women's interests. They just had a very different way of interpreting what those interests were.
Now, before 1960, it looks like in your book, these debates were really academic debates. There still wasn't in the legislature. There was no thrust or organized movement to try to change the law. Even though people were arguing about changing the law, were there any organizations that were actually actively trying to change laws before the 1960s?
No, you're right. It was very much an academic debate. In 1959, the debate moved into the legal field when the American Law Institute adopted an abortion law liberalization proposal as part of its model penal code. And so when that went out to lawyers around the country in 1959, it prompted a legal movement to legalize what was called therapeutic abortion, that is, abortion in exceptional cases, rape or incest, dangerous to a woman's health, and suspected fetal deformity. What's striking is that even at that point, women were still not really involved in the debate, and their opinions were not solicited. Because both the lawyers and the doctors, and to a certain extent, I think the state legislators, viewed this as a strictly medical issue, and when they thought of a medical issue, they thought of medical professionals who were men. they thought of the women simply as patients, simply as subjects. And so even as the debate became a political debate in the early 1960s, women's voices were not heard until women, in response to some of these legislative proposals, began speaking out on their own. On the pro-choice side, some women, like Pat McGinnis, said these laws are far too restrictive. The proposals that the American Law Institute was making were proposals that would leave women without access to abortion in the vast majority of cases. Whereas on the other side, for women who would emerge as leaders in the Right to Life movement, when they heard about these proposals, they viewed these proposals as an attack on human life and as an attack on their own view of women as mothers. And so they mobilized on the other side. But in both cases, women had to take the lead in their own right, become actors, and interject themselves into a debate that I think men were happy to have on their own without consulting women, even though, of course, this very much concerns women's bodies.
Now, the pro-life movement before then never was really one gigantic movement that was monolithic. There were a variety of opinions about abortion, what could be allowed, what could not be allowed, and also the idea that nothing should be done because it was more private morality that could not be regulated. And it's true that abortion laws are very difficult to enforce. History has already shown that. And so there were some people who were pro-life who maybe held back and said, you know, we can't really make do anything with this. This is a private morality issue. Was that an issue that was also taken up by the advocates of abortion, that, hey, this is a private morality issue, this is a private idea or choice? It wasn't a woman's choice at that point, but was that idea there?
Yes, and especially in the mid-1960s, as the Right to Life movement began organizing and showing up at state legislative debates, supporters of abortion legalization commonly made the argument, and this argument was especially associated with the California Episcopal priest Lester Kensalving, the argument that because Americans disagreed about the point at which human life began and therefore disagreed about abortion, the government should not take one particular religious view, which he argued was what the abortion laws had done, take one particular religious view and impose that on the rest of the population, that instead people should have the right to make these decisions. And at first, in the mid-1960s, most of the people would have emphasized the doctor's right to make the decision. But, of course, by the early 1970s, the person making the decision had shifted from the doctor to the woman. And ever since then, in the reproductive rights movement, the emphasis has been given to the woman's choice rather than the doctor's choice. But yes, that wasn't an argument. The argument that the pro-life movement made in response was that while some issues were of morality should certainly remain in the private sphere, if it's an area in which human life is at stake, then the government has a responsibility to intervene in order to protect human life.
Now, for the most part, in your history, Catholics are really the ones who are doing this advocacy for against abortion, and Protestants are not buying it. And one of the reasons that you note is the whole issue of contraception. The contraception was becoming much more acceptable, particularly among Protestants, and the Catholic pro-life people were sort of tying contraception and abortion together.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about how contraception sort of muddled the whole debate? Because it was all thrown together, and other people wanted to separate it out.
Yes. The Catholic Church became, after the 1920s and 1930s, the leading church body in the United States, and really the only prominent one, that was strongly opposed to the use of contraception. Most Protestant groups, especially the mainline Protestants, made peace with contraception, officially endorsed the practice after the 1930s. So because the Catholic Church not only taught against contraception, but also attempted in the case of some New England states, such as Massachusetts and Connecticut, to enforce its views through public law, that is, by campaigning against efforts to rescind prohibitions on contraception that had dated back to the late 19th century. The Catholic Church, therefore, made a lot of enemies among Protestants who resented the idea that the Catholic Church was attempting to impose what looked like simply a matter of Catholic doctrine on the rest of the population by denying others the right to contraception as they saw it. And because the Catholic Church linked its arguments against abortion with its arguments against contraception, arguing that both sets of arguments were grounded in the same natural law principles, it therefore became easy for Protestants in the early to mid-1960s to start dismissing the Catholic arguments against abortion as well. It looked like the same sectarian fight. And one of the reasons I think that the pro-life movement succeeded in becoming a national movement rather than ending up in the dustbin of history, as to a large extent it appears the Catholic campaign against contraception did, is because a number of Catholics recognized in the mid to late 1960s that they had to reframe the abortion debate. They had to reframe the pro-life arguments to completely dissociate themselves from the Church's teaching on contraception. While not denying the Church's teaching on contraception, they argued that that was really irrelevant to the arguments they were making against abortion, that abortion was in a completely different category. And they attempted, somewhat successfully, to get allies among Protestants, many of whom, probably most of whom actually, strongly supported the use of contraception and yet had serious qualms about abortion.
Okay, so this was really interesting to me how the Catholic pro-life movement basically changed their strategy in order to enlarge the movement and have more weight. They had to somehow appeal to Protestants because the Catholics were the minority. So you're saying that they did this by decoupling abortion from contraception. And there was also the issues of sexual morality that was also tied up in there, too. And they were trying to get that out of there, too.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yes. Well, most of the pro-life activists were somewhat traditional in their views of sexuality, church teaching, even to a certain extent, gender roles. But they were also political liberals. They, like the majority of Catholics, supported the New Deal, even to a large extent, the Great Society. They supported the general concept of human rights, of universal human rights. They supported the idea of a state that cared for the well-being of others. And so there were multiple sets of beliefs on which they could ground their pro-life activism. And up until the mid-1960s, while many of them did ground their claims for the rights of the unborn in human rights ideology, in New Deal liberalism, and claims to care for the less fortunate, they also linked it to their sexual conservatism. That is, in talking about abortion, they might bring in discussions of contraception. They might bring in discussions of their objection to sex outside of marriage. But after the mid-1960s, recognizing the failure of this, a number of people like Father James McHugh, who played a leading role in forming the National Right to Life Committee, which became the nation's largest anti-abortion group, made a conscious decision, a decision that actually we have documentary records of, and I quote from some of those records in my book, a conscious decision to stop talking about contraception and to welcome people into the movement who did not share their views on contraception, and in the case of a few liberal Protestants, even wanted to distribute contraception to unmarried women and girls in order to try to reduce out-of-wedlock pregnancy and reduce abortion rates. And the pro-life movement was willing to welcome these people, even though there was internal division, and even though there were a number of theologically conservative Catholics that had some objections to this, the general view in the movement, the widespread view, was that if the movement was going to succeed, people had to focus strictly on discussions of human life. They had to make arguments that would appeal to secular people, to Protestants, to Jews, to those who did not share Catholic doctrine, and they believed they could do that by using the language of liberalism.
And one of the things that they did was the whole idea of unwed mothers, of supporting. Some of the women said, we need to support unwed mothers and provide for their support so that they will have these babies. And instead of ostracizing them or shunning them, so there is a morality issue being against a premarital sex, but you've got a woman who's not married, who's pregnant, and now you're going to offer support, you know, all kinds of economic support to help her carry that child to term. So that is where your progressive ideas come into play with morality at the same time.
Yes, and it's striking to me that many of the leaders in the pro-life movement, both women and men, but especially women, in the early 1970s, pushed strongly for not only private assistance for unwed mothers, which they very much supported, but even public assistance. So the pro-life movement favored an expansion of the social welfare program, or at least some pro-life organizations did, like Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, for example, and the pro-life movement in North Dakota, came out on record as in support of prenatal insurance, in support of women facing crisis pregnancies, receiving governmental health insurance and governmental assistance in other forms, in support of expanded social welfare provisions. And, in fact, they argued that the abortion rights movement, the people on the opposition, were supporting an expansion of abortion precisely because they wanted to cut social welfare costs. And while that probably was not true for the majority of people in the abortion rights movement, it's certainly true that there were some state legislators who did vote for the legalization of abortion precisely for that reason. So they argued that actually they were taking a stand in defense of women who they believed, for the most part, the vast majority of people in the pro-life movement would have believed that those women had at least made a mistake, probably even committed an act that, according to church teaching, was sinful, and yet they believed that by assisting them, by refusing to judge them, and even offering state assistance to them, that they could prevent what they saw as a far worse evil.
Now, in the 1960s, there are a lot of things going on that really began to help reconfigure this pro-life movement. We have Vatican II, which weakens Catholic lay people's commitment to contraception, for one, and begins to erode even Catholic sentiment against abortion. Okay, so that's, we have some high profile cases that you talk about. And one of them was very interesting, was the Sherry Finkbein case. I think she was the host of Romper Room, a child's program. And talk about that case, because I thought that was a very interesting case because it was very, very visible in public.
Right. And it was really the first time in 1962 when that happened that newspapers began publicly talking about a specific woman's abortion for the first time, and debating that and even sympathizing with it. So what happened is that in the summer of 1962, Sherry Chesson Finkbein, who was married with several children of her own and who was a national children's television star, had a very pro-family image, became pregnant. It was a pregnancy that she and her husband wanted. But in the early weeks of the pregnancy, she found out that a thalidomide-based tranquilizer that she had been taking was known to cause birth defects. And she panicked, and she decided that she needed to terminate her pregnancy rather than risk giving birth to a severely deformed child. So she went to her doctor in her hospital and probably would have been able to have the abortion even though technically it was not legal. There were hospital abortion committees everywhere in the country at that point, and it was relatively easy for an upper middle class professional woman to get an abortion at a hospital. If you can make a plausible case that that in the eyes of the doctors, there was a good reason for it. So even though Arizona law allowed for abortion only in the case in which a woman's life was in danger, the doctors were willing to sign off on this. However, she made the mistake of then going to the press and telling them about what she was doing before the abortion took place. And at that point, the hospital abortion committee panicked, the legal apparatus in Arizona panicked, and this became a national debate. Sherry Chesson Finkbein and her husband realized they would not be able to get an abortion anywhere in the United States at that point because under strict interpretation of the law, suspected fetal deformity was not grounds for a legal abortion, even though, as I said, there were a lot of hospitals that would be willing to grant that as long as it was private. But now that this was public knowledge, she and her husband traveled to Sweden. They had the abortion there, then came back to the United States. And they argued that that this fetus had been deformed, that it was the right decision. And this set off a nationwide debate. Numerous people supported the Finkbeins in their decision. And it set into motion a legal campaign to pass the laws that the American Law Institute had already suggested, that is, laws that would allow for abortion in these cases, in cases of suspected fetal deformity. But in the view of many Catholics who believed that human life began at conception, this seemed to be, to use your word earlier, slippery slope. It was the beginning of a dangerous slippery slope, because they argued that if one said that the fetus's life could be terminated on grounds that it was deformed, then why not kill newborn babies who were also severely deformed? What would stop this slippery slope from advancing into infanticide? And what did it say about the country at that very moment that so many people who otherwise said that they opposed abortion and who thought that perhaps this fetus had value that should be protected in law, nevertheless said, if there are suspected fetal deformities, then perhaps an abortion could occur? And so once again, this debate between a utilitarian argument and an argument of absolute rights for the fetus once again entered the public sphere, and this time, because this was a nationally covered issue in the nation's newspapers, it spilled out of hospitals, medical conferences, legal conferences, and actually spilled into state legislatures, pages of people's newspapers, and churches.
There was one thing that was in this case that I thought was really interesting that you talk about. These hospital boards that would make these decisions about whether an abortion was justified based on these very restrictive abortion laws. The idea of the health of the mother extended beyond, became more than just the physical health. It became about the mental health of the mother. So
right.
That I think didn't Sherry Finkbein claim, or it was a claim that she would have couldn't bear having a deformed child, and it would depress her, and she might have commit suicide. There were all these mental health things that were brought into it. It wasn't just the physical health any longer.
Yes, the state abortion laws, which had been passed in the late 19th century, said that abortion was illegal except in cases in which a woman's life was in danger. There were a handful of states, fewer than 10, that would extend the permission to abortion in cases when a woman's health was in danger as well. But most states said that abortion was legal only when a woman's life itself was in danger. And, of course, when the legislators in the late 19th century had passed that law, they had in mind a situation that was relatively common in the late 19th century, which was a pregnancy that would likely cause a woman to die immediately if a woman tried to give birth. This, of course, was before the era of the safe C-section. And so, as we know, of course, the C-section is very common today. And if you can imagine a significant number of those cases being brought to term, but without the ability to deliver except vaginally, then this would be a case in which a significant number of women would face the choice between abortion or death. By the 1950s, those cases had become extremely rare, just as they're rare today. They were not non-existent, but they were now extremely rare because there was a safe C-section by the 1950s. There were antibiotics. There was improved medical care. And so hospital abortion committees, which were a phenomenon of the post-World War II era, hospital abortion committees often, though not invariably, would allow women to receive abortion for what they called psychiatric indications. And by the late 1950s, this had become by far the most common reason for abortion. Psychiatric indications meant something similar to what you described. That is, a woman would say that if she didn't have an abortion, that maybe she would be a suicide risk. And a psychologist would sign off on this statement, and the hospital abortion committee would approve this on grounds that they had saved a woman's life. But to opponents of abortion, especially to some of these Catholic doctors, this looked like rank hypocrisy. They believed this was violating the intention of the law, at the very least the spirit of the law, if not the letter, and they wanted to put an end to this.
Now, up to now, that we're talking the 1960s, before the feminist movement really starts rolling, the advocates for liberalization of abortion laws are arguing from all kinds of angles, but they still are not arguing from what the feminist would come out with, and that was the right to choose.
Yes.
Which was a completely different argument. It wasn't so much about the health or, you know, the betterment of society or controlling population or all the kinds of different. It was about fundamentally the woman having control over her own body.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about that and how that changed the entire debate. It changed the debate significantly.
It did. In 1967, the National Organization for Women Now passed a resolution saying that they believed that all laws against abortion should be repealed, that a woman should have the right to make that decision herself. And that, at the time, was a radical proposal that the vast majority of Americans did not support. Public opinion polls in the mid-1960s showed that perhaps about 15% of Americans supported that idea at most. But because of the success of the women's rights movement, because of the changes in societal opinion about women's rights and gender roles, that number increased to about 40% by the beginning of the 1970s. There were a significant number of Americans who changed their opinion on abortion sometime between about 1967 and 1971. And in addition, the abortion legalization movement itself changed its language. So by the end of the 1960s, what had been the common demand on the side of the abortion liberalization advocates in 65, 66, 67, which is that they could simply liberalize the existing law while still preserving the general framework in which abortion was not legal in most cases, that had given way to a belief that this should be a woman's decision. Now, in actual practice, most advocates of abortion rights in the early 1970s continued to use language that was a little bit more nuanced. They usually said a woman in consultation with her doctor. And in fact, that's language that appears in Roe v. Wade. And I think for a lot of feminists today, a lot of reproductive rights advocates today, they actually don't like the way Roe v. Wade is written. They agree with the general outcome of the case, but they wished that the language had been different, that the legal reasoning had been a little bit different, because Roe v. Wade in many ways was still a doctor's rights decision, a medical rights decision, rather than strictly a women's rights decision or a clear feminist victory. Nevertheless, although the move was not instantaneous, by the early 1970s, there emerged in this abortion legalization campaign an argument that I think could truly be called pro-choice. That is, a woman has the right to make decisions about her own reproduction, about her own body, and the state does not have the right to tell her what to do. And that's the way that many pro-choicers framed the debate in the early 1970s.
Now, the abortion rights proponents are gaining incredible amount of public sentiment. It's increasing, while the pro-life people are making some, having some victories in the legislatures in the early 1970s, as you indicate. So you've got, it's kind of, it's not going parallel. They're making gains in the legislature, but the public opinion is going, becoming more and more about liberalization of abortion laws. So that's an interesting moment, but then all of a sudden you've got Roe v. Wade, which basically totally undoes all the legislative victories that the pro-life movement had gained.
Yes. So, I think a lot of people are not aware of the legislative history on abortion immediately before Roe v. Wade. And what I point out in the book is a story that I think may surprise some people. But between 1967 and 1970, the pro-life movement suffered a string of defeats. There were 19 states that legalized abortion in some form or another. Most passed the moderate therapeutic abortion bill that had allowed for abortion only in exceptional cases. But four states in 1970, including most prominently New York, passed laws that legalized elective abortion into the second trimester, if not actually through the end of the second trimester. And so it looked like a major defeat for the pro-life movement. By December 1970, or by the fall of 1970, any woman who could find a way to travel to New York and pay for a hospital abortion could have a legal abortion, no questions asked. And then the pro-life movement changed their strategy. They began using fetal photographs. They began using more graphic descriptions of abortion, and they capitalized on a public discomfort with what was called abortion on demand. The idea that a woman could simply walk into a hospital and terminate her pregnancy in the first or second trimester without giving any reason for it bothered a lot of people at the time. Even though the support for abortion rights was gaining ground, and even though in 1970 approximately 40% of Americans did say they believed in the legalization of elective abortion, the pro-life movement was able, in a few strategic political campaigns, such as, say, a debate over an abortion referendum in Michigan in 1972, they were able to capitalize on public discomfort with at least second trimester abortions, and thereby swing the debate to their side. So in 1971, there were about 25 state legislatures that considered some form of abortion legalization, and pro-lifers won every single one of those debates. It was an astonishing range of victory. And then in 1972, the same thing happened. A number of state legislatures considered abortion legalization, and pro-lifers won every one except one of those debates. So by January 1973, the abortion rights movement was worried. Yes, they'd been making a lot of gains in public opinion, but they had lost in referenda, in debates at the polls over abortion in the fall of 1972. They had lost in state legislatures. Their only victory was really coming, their only source of victory was really coming from the courts. And it appeared, at least in New York, that pro-lifers might be on the verge of even repealing the nation's most liberal abortion law. So the debate was not necessarily fully going in the side of either camp by the January of 1973, but at least politically, at least legislatively, the pro-lifers seemed to be winning. Then Roe v. Wade came, and it deprived pro-lifers of these victories that they had won in the past 2 or 3 years. And furthermore, it mandated a change of law for all but four states. That is, 46 states had to change their laws to bring them into compliance with Roe. And that set off a backlash from the pro-life movement. So even though, as I mentioned at the beginning, Roe didn't create the abortion debate, Roe certainly exacerbated the abortion debate. It ruled in favor of one set of rights claims, and it ruled against another set of rights claims, and it resulted in an immediate rapid growth in the pro-life movement, so that pro-life organizations greatly expanded their membership in 1973 and 1974.
And also, you had some radicalization also in the pro-life movement. on the fringes. Some people were radicalized, and there were violence, and there was a lot of use of images and of fetuses being destroyed, and very dramatic sort of tactics, and having to develop new tactics or new ways to persuade the public that Roe v. Wade had been a mistake and it needed to be overturned as quickly as possible.
Right. The violence, so the use of violent images, of graphic images, of images that were designed to shock in a very visceral way, predated Roe, and it expanded after Roe. It was a reaction, I think, to the passage of these first elective abortion legalization laws in 1970. And as soon as that happened in New York and three other states, that's when the pro-life movement began using considerably more graphic rhetoric and images. But the actual violence, that is, attacks on clinics, came well after Roe. It wasn't an immediate reaction. It started in the late 1970s, and it was still relatively uncommon and mostly directed against property in the late 1970s, but it continued escalating in the 80s. The 1980s was a time when the anti-abortion movement became considerably more militant, and new factions in the pro-life movement developed that embraced techniques that bothered some older pro-lifers. I mean, they're veterans of the early pro-life movement of the pre-Roe era, were in large part very upset with first civil disobedience, and then attacks on clinics, attempts to firebomb clinics, and then, of course, finally, in the early 90s, an actual killing of people.
Now, we have to be fair here, the pro-choice side was also involved in using images of women who had been butchered and died at the hands of, you know, illegal abortions.
Right.
And that was also a very high sympathy kind of propaganda campaign, because it was, this is why abortion has to be legal, and it's in order for it to be safe.
Right. And the pro-life movement claimed that their use of such images was misleading. Of course, both sides objected to the other's images. But yes, in response to the pro-life movement's use of fetal images in the early 1970s, the pro-choice movement adopted as its symbol the coat hanger. And they began publishing pictures, not as numerous as the pro-life movement's images, but still, nonetheless, they published a few pictures of women who had died as a result of dangerous illegal abortions. And their argument was, this is what will happen if abortion laws, that is, laws legalizing abortion, are repealed. The pro-life movement claimed, and this is actually true, that the numbers of women who had died from illegal abortions had been rapidly decreasing in the 1950s and 1960s, so that in the 1930s, before penicillin, before other antibiotics, the number of women who had died per year from illegal abortions was probably in the thousands, somewhere around 5,000 women per year, maybe even as high as 10,000 women per year. But by the early 1960s, those numbers had dropped to fewer than 300 per year, and they continued to drop in the 1960s. So pro-lifers argued with, I think, validity that this claim that thousands of women were dying per year from illegal abortions was an outdated figure at best and an exaggeration at worst. But it's also true on the pro-choice side that the legalization of abortion did result in a reduction in the number of women who died from the procedure. So even though the numbers were quite low by the late 1960s, they were significantly higher than zero. There were a few dozen at minimum women died per year from illegal abortions in the late 1960s. And so the legalization of abortion did save some women's lives. And the pictures that the pro-choice movement collected of some rather graphic deaths of women, I think, brought that argument to the public in a very visceral way.
Well, Dan, we're almost out of time, and I've got a lot of different questions for you, but we're not going to get to them. But I do want to ask you, what do you hope that your book will do in terms of the whole debate about abortion, the history of abortion? How do you think it will play, and what would you like to see?
I would like to see the book used as a way to gain a new understanding of the abortion debate as a debate between two different versions of liberalism. And so if abortion rights supporters, if supporters of reproductive rights realized that their opponents were not necessarily motivated by a backlash against women's rights or by even a set of conservative political concerns, but instead recognized that at least historically, the pro-life movement's arguments are grounded in a particular set of liberal values that are actually quite similar to the liberal values that shaped their own movement, the reproductive rights movement, that perhaps this could form the basis for an improvement in dialogue between the two sides. So in terms of contemporary politics, I think this book has the potential to have a practical effect that would be beneficial. But also in terms of historical understanding, I think that this book sheds new light on the strange turns in American politics, on the way in which a debate that maybe we thought we understood actually played out very differently than what many people believe. And I hope that simply because of historical curiosity and also a desire to understand our own times and the debates of our own times, that people would want to pick up this book.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. Contact me through my website, www.lillianbarger.com.